The music teacher says it was consensual sex. His former students say it was rape.
He had sex with me once in the classroom, in a closet.
Something happened to me too.
I thought he was our little predator.
Why wasn't he stopped? These women seek answers and justice. I'm Julie Ireton, host of a new podcast, The Banned Teacher. It's available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Just that somebody could be this diabolical.
This is a CBC podcast.
Bakhmut has seen the longest and bloodiest battle since the war in Ukraine began. This week, Russia's Wagner group said they have taken the city, but Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky continued to argue that's not true.
Now our people are accomplishing a very important mission. They are now in Bakhmut. I will not share where exactly, but it witnesses that Bakhmut is not occupied by Russian Federation as of today.
Finbar O'Reilly is a Canadian photographer, regular contributor to the New York Times. He is in Kharkiv this morning. Finbar, hello.
Hi, Matt.
You have been in Bakhmut for the New York Times covering this siege. When were you there last?
The last time I was there was in October and November, and at that time the city was under heavy assault, as it has been for the last year. And I spent the day in a what they call a stabilization point, which is about a kilometer or so from the zero line, which is where the two sides are clashing in the trenches. And the stabilization point is where they would bring the wounded who were coming in droves, with blast wounds from artillery strikes and frontline fighting.
How have you seen the city change over the time that you have been in that city?
Yeah, so I went into Bakhmut a number of times over the last year, and the first time I went in, it was the towns and villages on the periphery of Bakhmut itself, further east and north, that were the scenes of the heaviest fighting and the heaviest shelling from the Russian side. And little by little, the Russian advance has kind of moved forward, first taking the salt mining town of Soledar to the north of Bakhmut, and then focused its sights on Bakhmut itself. And the Russian military doctrine is, as we've seen in Chechnya, as we've seen in Syria, when they focus on a town to target, they tend to attack it with artillery, block by block, street by street, and will pummel certain areas and just wipe out everything in that block. Then they'll move to the next block on the grid and the next block on the grid. And so what you've seen is a systematic kind of destruction of Bakhmut as the Russian advance has moved in forward incrementally. And what was a pretty town that was known for making sparkling wine, and you know, gypsum caves where that wine was aged underground, has now been largely flattened, and all the buildings are kind of just smashed, shattered, charred from you know, constant artillery strikes over the past year. The trees are splintered, and over the winter you had scenes that looked like something from, you know, World War II trench warfare, World War I trench warfare, just really, really grim and bleak scenes. And the city now, when we look at some of the drone images that our team photographers produced from there this week, it is just a shell of what it once was.
Again, you take a look at those drone images, it looks like something from a post-apocalyptic film. Like, there's very little that's left. And the Times published some of your photos earlier this week from Bakhmut. There's one of what looks like there was a building that was there and it's just been reduced to rubble. It's surrounded by other apartment blocks and there are cars that are destroyed in that courtyard. What was going on there?
Yeah, that was just another, I was in a way, just a normal morning. You know, the artillery strikes are hitting the buildings and any of the vehicles that happen to be parked in the nearby compounds. And this is what I was describing with just this systematic shelling of cities block by block. And I've just spent the last month or so documenting other towns and cities in that eastern and southern region that have been systematically leveled in this same way, so that all you have left are stumps of buildings. And, you know, we think of of battles as advancing, you know, in a vertical way forward across distance. But a lot of this fighting has also been vertical, where the Russians are leveling the buildings through artillery one floor at a time. So a 9-story building gets shattered down to 8 stories, 7, 6, 5, until it's just nothing but a pile of rubble. And that removes the ability of the Ukrainian defenders from being able to operate and hide in those buildings, to the point where they're just hiding in underground bunkers and shelters below the rubble in many cases.
You mentioned in some ways some of the scenes take you back to, you know, the trench warfare of the Great Wars. Tell me a little bit about the conditions that the Ukrainian defense were operating in and around that city.
So the times that I was embedded with the Ukrainian military in Bakhmut, I would travel in with them and I would move to their positions, whether it was a mortar position or a machine gun position. At the time, you know, there was kind of an encirclement of the Russian forces around the outskirts of Bakhmut as they progressed inward and fighting block by block, city by, you know, and then house to house. So the place was under constant shellfire. It was rare that you'd have more than a minute or so go by without something exploding, in, you know, within a few blocks. And so they operated mostly underground, coming, you know, from bunkers. A lot of the buildings in these areas have basements. The homes have root cellars where people tend to store their potatoes and beets and all kinds of other things. So the fighters tend to move from underground position to underground position or from the well-protected buildings and only pop up to fire back. And the combat is, you know, has been going house to house, has been incredibly brutal as it got closer and closer quarters in the city. So it would go from a range of a few hundred meters from building to building and then from floor to floor within the bigger buildings. So it was incredibly intense. Some of the deadliest and most intense fighting that's been seen in Europe since the Second World War.
There's a scene that you captured of a couple of soldiers at what was the last pizza stand in Bakhmut. Can you describe that?
Oh yeah, this was last year, probably around this time. At that time, the Ukrainians were still fully in control of the whole city, and there were, you know, still several thousand people living in this city that once had 70,000 people, but all of the restaurants were closed. The market was not really operating because it was occasionally coming under shelling. So one of the few places was a little kiosk that was selling hot dogs and pizzas and coffee and soft drinks. So the soldiers tended to congregate there in between fighting. And, you know, they were pushing at that time out to the outskirts of the city. So that place was operational. But certainly that place has long since been shut down, as has everything in the city. And there are very few people who remain there now.
What did the soldiers tell you about the importance of this? We're going to speak more about the strategic importance of this in just a few moments. But from what you learned from those soldiers who were there in those grim conditions fighting, and this dragged on and on and on, what did they tell you about why this battle was so important?
So the thing about soldiers who are in these situations, they're tending not to think so much about the bigger picture. They're thinking about, you know, we've just got to survive this day. We've just got to get through this. When we talk about the strategy, that's, you know, that's where it's coming from the politicians and the military strategists about why they're fighting there. These guys would just say, we have to hold Bakhmut. This is where we're standing our ground. We've seen the Ukrainian army stand its ground in a number of other places over the years. They held off in Kyiv at the beginning of the war. There was a long standoff in Mariupol before that fell. And so the Ukrainians tend to just sort of hunker down and they'll say, we're going to hold this place. And it became this focus of a war of attrition. Estimates are that 100,000 Russian casualties, perhaps, with maybe 20,000 dead, as the Russians sent waves of human waves at the Ukrainian positions. And so, you know, the soldiers there are really just kind of focusing on the fight, what they need to do, the rotations they're doing. They'll come back underground, take a break, head to the underground bunkers, and then they'll go back out on their missions to their positions and operate. They're really thinking in a kind of day-to-day, moment-to-moment sort of way, whereas the overall strategies are coming from much higher up on the, you know, the military chain.
For civilians who didn't leave, and again, as you said, a huge proportion of the population has fled the city. What do you know about what life is like for them?
Extremely rough. You know, what I found, not just in Bakhmut, but in other cities across the industrial, eastern region of Ukraine, in Donbas, is that the people who tend to remain are the elderly, the infirm, the impoverished, and those who are older and may have a kind of nostalgia or sympathies toward Russia. Often these are called the waiters, the ones who are waiting for the Russians to come. So the elderly and the infirm are people who are, they feel like there's no point in them leaving. This is their home. No matter how hard it gets, they don't have, they're too old, they're too ill to relocate. They can't face or fathom the idea of moving to somewhere else and living as a displaced person in another part of Ukraine. This is, we're talking about people who are on the kind of the lowest level of the social structure. And so, they're surviving in basements, no electricity, no water, no gas, cold through the winter. There were deliveries of humanitarian aid while the Ukrainians still held some control in the city. But what that looks like now is very difficult to say. Presumably the Russians are there and they're having to interact with them. And maybe there's some humanitarian support being offered to the remaining civilians who are in the city. But we just don't know that at this stage.
You have been at the front lines of a number of different conflicts in your work as a photographer. I just wonder how what you saw in Bakhmut compares to what you've seen elsewhere.
I think, the kind of destruction and shelling, I've seen a bit of that, in places like Gaza. But really this kind of wholesale wiping out of a city systematically, block by block, street by street, through intense artillery strikes and aerial bombardments is just another scale. I haven't seen anything of this nature in other conflicts, but I've seen it, throughout the eastern part of Ukraine. And, Bakhmut is one example. There are a number of others where this kind of, wide, broad scale destruction has reduced a once vibrant city to just rubble, essentially. The intensity of the fighting, of course.
Is there one image just finally that is kind of burned into your mind from that city and from the people that you met who are trying to make their way through this destruction?
There have been so many indelible images by photographers, Ukrainian photographers and foreign photographers from Bakhmut and the war generally. If I'm talking about my own photographs, I think it would be just, one of the days that I spent in this stabilization point where the wounded were being brought in. It was up to, some days it would be 80, other days it would be 100 or 200 to this place, and all just riddled with shrapnel injuries. Not all of them survived. So I think, one of them was a guy whose hand had been blown off. He got shrapnel through his body and the surgeons were operating on him. But as grim as the situation was, the surgeons managed to keep up quite a light and humorous banter to try and keep their own morale up. But also the soldiers who were, seriously wounded and whose lives were going to be forever changed and trying to get them through that initial amount of first aid for an hour so that they could be shipped out into proper care hours away at a proper hospital. So I think it's less than an image than a moment spent in that intensity of that first aid center where people were just being treated, civilians as well who'd been wounded by the shelling, were brought in, patched up, and then shipped out for more care. Those were the lucky ones who survived. The number of dead and wounded over the last year in Bakhmut is just staggering to try and imagine.
These are remarkable images of a very grim situation, as you've been saying. Finbar, I'm glad to talk to you about them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finbar O'Reilly is a Canadian photographer and a regular contributor to the New York Times. We reached him in eastern Ukraine.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of the Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at the Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Alexander Lanoshka is an assistant professor of international relations at the University of Waterloo. Alexander, good morning to you.
Good morning to you as well.
Volodymyr Zelensky has said that Bakhmut is not fully occupied by Russian forces or mercenaries that are under the employ of Russia. This has been disputed, certainly this week, but in weeks earlier as well. Who actually controls the city, do you believe?
So Russia has claimed victory over Bakhmut several times now, but it looks like in this particular point in time, Russian forces do seem to be occupying the large majority of that city. Ukraine forces are still in there, but they still seem to be there only with respect to some of the outskirts of that city. And so we are seeing the Wagner group, a mercenary group that's really connected to the Kremlin, announced very recently that is resting and withdrawing from the city, such that regular Russian army forces are going to be taking over operations in Bakhmut, which does signal that Russia seems to be occupying, again, a majority of that city.
Is your sense that those troops would be able to hold the city?
Well, that's the big question. So Ukraine is currently preparing to undertake a major counteroffensive. It's not clear what direction or in what sectors that counteroffensive will take place. It's possible that that counteroffensive could be in the direction of Bakhmut. We don't know. Only a handful of individuals do know. So it's very difficult for Russia to maintain forces all across the large front line that currently exists in Ukraine. And indeed, they will suffer certain strains in holding Bakhmut. But we'll see how the counteroffensive goes.
Why was this city in particular a site of such a bloody battle? Why were these two sides so dug in here?
From Russia's perspective, the city had strategic value insofar as it was a local rail and transport hub. So it had certain logistic uses that would serve Russian forces along the north-south axis. Holding the city would also allow Russia to break out into the western direction away from Bakhmut. That being said, precisely because of the sheer number of casualties that Russia has incurred, some estimates range as high as 100,000, as you've heard. Lower end estimates are about 20,000. But regardless, those numbers are staggeringly high. And one wonders whether they really are proportionate to the strategic value associated with the city. From Ukraine's perspective, there is a certain value, for more or less the same reasons. However, there has been some admission on the Ukraine side that political logic guided some of the decision-making involved here to retain Ukraine forces in Bakhmut to fight off Russian forces. And indeed, precisely because of the looming counteroffensive that Ukraine is going to take, there's a sense that by focusing on Bakhmut, by making sure that Russia remains committed to the taking of Bakhmut for its own political reasons, because there is a psychological benefit perhaps associated with taking the city, that would force Russia to remove some forces away from other parts of the front line so that the counteroffensive could enjoy more success elsewhere in Ukraine. So, but there's certainly a psychological benefit too from Ukraine. So long as Russia is struggling to take even kilometers of territory, this will certainly sap Russian resources and manpower in a way that might rebound to Ukraine's long-term strategic benefit moving forward.
Would this be considered a victory for Russia taking the city? I mean, if you lose 100,000 troops, but you still manage to have control of the city, would that be classified as some sort of victory in a war that I think most people agree has not gone particularly well for Russia?
They would certainly classify it as a victory. And indeed, we see rhetoric to that effect. But I think this would qualify as a Pyrrhic victory, whereby the costs are so high that they might very well undo some of the successes that Russia might have today as regards to fighting that it has undertaken along that particular axis.
There has, as you've mentioned, been a lot of talk about the so-called spring offensive from Ukraine. The sense is now that, the conditions are ripe for that to happen. The weather has dried up. The sun is out in some parts of Russia, or in Ukraine, pardon me. What do you expect that spring offensive against the Russian troops to look like?
So I personally dislike the discourse surrounding the counteroffensive, precisely because there's a lot of inflated expectations as to what it might entail. Ukraine already took two counteroffensives last year. One was Kharkiv, which was a major rout of Russian forces, liberating a large swath of territory. And I think a lot of people expect the upcoming counteroffensive to look a lot like the Kharkiv counteroffensive of the fall of last year. However, there was yet another counteroffensive that took place in Kherson, which unfolded over several months. It led to the liberation of the city of Kherson, but it was very much a grind for Ukraine forces. I'm not sure which of those two models the upcoming counteroffensive will take, but this is going to be a very difficult military operation for Ukrainian armed forces to undertake. It could be very costly in terms of casualties, and I think the reason why Ukraine has not yet launched it, despite all the talks surrounding it, is precisely because Ukraine does want to conserve its forces. It does want to have as much equipment and as much ammunition as possible for it to maximize its chances for success. But I think, again, it probably will not result in the quick liberation of much territory, precisely because Russia still has about 200-some thousand forces in the country. It has built fortifications along certain vectors of the country. It's possible that these areas of fortifications are undermanned, and it's possible that Russia is suffering from various ammunition shortages too. There's so much we don't know. But I think the best expectation one could have is that it might take a little longer than people might think. It might not happen all at once. It might liberate smaller portions of territory here and there. But eventually it will build into something bigger, but it will take time.
You mentioned equipment, and there's been a lot of talk around Ukraine has made these requests for months now for Western fighter jets. Now seems to be actually happening that Ukraine will get F-16 fighter jets from Western allies. Is this for this current conflict? I'd read some people saying that perhaps this is for a future conflict, that these jets are not going to arrive in any immediate way. What's your sense of that?
My sense is that these jets will not arrive anytime soon. Training is only beginning in a few countries involving a few pilots from Ukraine. And as such, what the F-16 represents is not necessarily a commitment on the part of the West to Ukraine, but rather a recognition that even if Ukraine succeeds this year or even next, in this particular war, that the F-16s would be useful indeed for deterring the next war. So I think there is a future value associated with the F-16s, not so much a present value. As much as it would be nice to have those capabilities for this particular iteration of the conflict, I think the Ukrainian authorities are realistic about this particular capability, when they could expect to have it. And as such, the meaning of this capability is going to be very different from, say, the Leopards, the HIMARS, and other key capabilities that Ukraine has received from the West over the course of the last year.
Just before we let you go, we're just about out of time, but your language suggests that this is nowhere near being over. It was interesting that the former Russian President Medvedev said that negotiations would be impossible with Zelensky still in power. So it would seem from statements like that Russia has no real appetite for negotiations right now. But your language suggests this is going to go on, as you say, for another year, if not years.
It depends. It really depends, again, on the counteroffensive. I'm trying to manage expectations, but if Ukraine does score major victories, then that could bring us closer to the end. I do suspect that, in a flip to what Medvedev had said, this war will last as long as Putin lives, in part because he has no interest in seeking some sort of peaceful settlement whatsoever. He might be forced to do so, given facts on the ground, but again, the facts on the ground remain as such that Russia does occupy about 17% of Ukraine territory, including Crimea. And there's a lot of hard work yet to be done on the side of Ukraine to liberate that territory.
Alexander, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Alexander Lenoshka is an assistant professor of international relations at the University of Waterloo.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.